the nation's capital. This is D.C. Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. Ladies and gentlemen, our title for today's show, Public Opinion, Sentencing, and Parole and Probation. We're very happy to have Adam Gelb. Adam is the director of the Public Safety Performance Project, which helps advance policies and practices in adult and juvenile sentencing and corrections that protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control correctional costs. As project lead, Adam oversees Pew's assistance to states and also research. He's been involved in crime control and prevention for the past 25 years as a journalist, congressional aide, a senior state government official. He graduated from the University of Virginia and holds a master's degree from Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Adam, welcome to D.C. Public Safety.
Great to be with you, Len.
Full disclosure, Adam and I worked together in the state of Maryland when he was a senior aide to the lieutenant governor, who eventually ran for governor, and I was leading public information for a state agency, law enforcement, and correctional agency. So Adam and I have worked together. I've seen Adam lead this charge in person. Nobody is a more passionate person and a more knowledgeable person on this issue of crime and justice. I want to read very quickly from one of the findings from Pew in terms of the research that they do. American voters believe that too many people are in prison and the nation spends too much on prison. Voters overwhelmingly support a variety of policy changes that shift nonviolent offenders from prison to more effective, less expensive alternatives. Number three, support for sentencing and correction reforms, including reduced prison terms, is strong across political parties, regions, age, gender, and racial and ethnic groups. Adam, the whole idea of Pew and the Public Safety Performance Project, give me a definition in one sentence.
You said it very well yourself, right?
We need to hear from you.
In one sentence. We help states advance policies and practices that protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control corrections costs.
When you and I talk in the past, and I say, Adam, you know, this whole issue of offender reentry, we're not an offender reentry program. We're about systematic policy change within the criminal justice system within the United States that does the things that you just articulated, correct?
That's right. You know, our project does look at the bigger system than just the very tail end of the system and making sure that when offenders get out of prison, they're set up for success.
Okay.
We look at the whole system from front end to back end. And right, the bulk of what we do is join into partnerships with states. When the governor, senior legislative leadership, the chief justice and judicial leaders say, we've got a problem here, we'd like to take a look at it, see what we can do about bending the curve on our corrections growth and making sure that prisons are holding the right people. And then we come in and, working with a bipartisan interbranch task force, take a look at the state's data, what specifically is driving the population, what's caused it to rise. We also do a look at the corrections and reentry policies, to what extent is that agency or agencies implementing what we know to be evidence-based practices. Mm-hmm. Based on that, and then only at that point, once we've taken a look at the data and the trends, do we then start to fashion policy solutions. And based on what the research says about what works, based on what other state experiences have been about what works or not, then we help the state put together a set of policy recommendations. And then thirdly, and this is really important about what we do, is that we don't just help the state and that task force put together a nice, pretty report with fancy graphs and great recommendations that's going to sit on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's an integral involvement of all the stakeholder groups and agencies from the get-go, and certainly the governor and the legislative leadership. And so our reports tend to make it across the finish line in the legislature and not sit on a shelf.
What you're looking for is systematic change at the state level. You're looking for systematic policy changes that reduces cost to state, yet at the same time improve public safety.
That's exactly right.
All right. And through that, and I'm going to say this, and it's not my opinion. I'm not expressing my opinion at all. I've talked to a wide variety of people at the national level, at the state level. Some people believe, again, I represent the federal government. I work with a lot of federal agencies. I do not mean to embarrass them. I love them half to death. But a lot of people express the opinion that Pew is not a leader in this issue of systematic change within the criminal justice system. Pew is the leader. Pew writes material in such a way that the average person can understand it, the average member of the General Assembly, that person's aide, citizens can understand what it is that you're talking about. You have a whole flow of writing. You have a whole flow of, in terms of your media events, of the video that you create. There's something very, very strategic in terms of the way that you communicate. You communicate in a way that government seems to be incapable of doing. Am I right or wrong?
Well, we have a few advantages there, both in terms of resources and in terms of the politics, right? Pew is an independent organization, self-funded to do this work, and so we do have a little bit more freedom to be creative in the way that we communicate.
And government cannot. And that's the interesting thing. People have simply said Pew can. That's the answer they've given, that Pew has the ability to communicate government, has an innate inability to communicate. So,
take the polling that you started off off the segment with here. We are able to go out and partner with some of the top pollsters in this country. One of the top Republican pollsters and one of the top Democratic pollsters teamed together on the poll that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And we're able to document with research into public opinion where people are on this, right? And I think the point that you're making, and one of the reasons why we're seeing so much change around the country at this point, is that elected officials are finally catching up with where voters and citizens are on these issues, mm-hmm. right? People are sick and tired of the revolving door.
How many states are you talking about that Pew is involved in?
About half the states over the past seven
years.
You're
talking about 25 states over the course of the last 7 years. Systematic examination is to how they do business, systematic examination as to how they can change.
That's right.
That's impossible. 25 states in the United States, and you've been able to do that on a systematic basis.
We've been working hard. We've had a tremendous amount of help from our partners at the Council of State Governments Justice Center, the Vera Institute of Justice, the Crime and Justice Institute,
Office
and many
of Justice
others.
Programs, yes.
BJA and the Office of Justice Programs, an integral partner in this effort,
right.
And it's been an amazing public-private partnership, particularly in that our strength and focus of our dollars can be on the front end of these reforms, trying to make sure that there is a solid policy package put together and making it across the finish line of the legislature. And then BJA has been able to really come in after that and provide some support to these states to make sure that the changes, and there are lots of them in many of these comprehensive packages, are actually implemented, because I think we all realize that a lot of the structural policy change that you're talking about sometimes isn't worth the paper that it's written on unless there's real follow-through by the courts and by probation and parole agencies.
Okay. I do, just out of respect for Pew, is to get across the point that Pew is multi-layered. Pew has been around for, 150,000 years and multi-layered. They do a lot of different things. It's really surprising how Pew is a daily part of my life as a bureaucrat within a federal agency in terms of a daily news summary, in terms of the material that you give me, in terms of public opinion of polls. So just Pew is multi-layered.
It certainly is. There are projects in many different areas of public policy, health policy, environment policy, and it's been fabulous that the institution has committed as much energy and resources as it has over the past 7 years to an area that is not really commonly thought of in a lot of philanthropic circles.
Okay, let's get down to this whole concept of the 25 states, Office of Justice Program, Bureau of Justice Assistance, Pew, Council of States. I mean, there's a lot of organizations involved in terms of this systematic change within the 25 states. I talk to reporters, and reporters go, okay, so this is all going on, not necessarily Pew now, but this whole sense of systematic change at the state level. How many criminologists have we talked to over the course of our careers who simply said, you know, I really believe that we should systematically do it differently, that we do over-incarcerate, that there should be more alternatives to incarceration, and just run down the laundry list. Endless numbers. Those endless numbers of people have spoken to, endless numbers of reporters. I contend that have reporters and street cops are the two of the most jaded people on the face of groups of people on the face of the earth. They're cynical. They look at me and their question is, their response is, so what? Show me the results as to where the alternatives, whatever they happen to be, are truly having an impact in terms of reduced crime and improved justice and at the same time reducing costs for the criminal justice system in that particular state. Show me, show me, show me. When I respond to it, I run off a laundry list of research that has had an impact, and their response is, okay, that doesn't quite do it for me, because most research projects, when they are successful, not all are successful, run in the ballpark of about 15% reduction in recidivism. They're interested in a safer America. Can you deliver on a safer America?
I think we're seeing governors and state legislators and judicial leaders across this country in those 25 states that have gone through the justice reinvestment process. I think we're seeing them deliver.
Okay.
Right? And they are. And I think it's I hope it's well known among your audience that Texas was one of the first states to go through this kind of process, and that in Texas in the last 7 years the prison population has stabilized. They expected to have to spend at this point now more than $2 billion to accommodate the increased growth that they were projecting. They haven't had to spend that money. The recidivism rate, the pro-revocation rate in that state is down by well over a third, and public safety, the most important piece of this puzzle, has improved across the state. The crime rate in Texas is back down to where it was in the 1960s.
And reporters are going to say, well, Leonard, but most states have seen reductions in crime across the board. We're just coming off an almost continuous 20-year reduction in crime across the board as measured by the FBI, as measured by the Bureau of Justice Statistics. However, for the last couple of years, it's starting to go up, both on the property and in violent, and again, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, there is a one-year increase as recorded by the FBI. So the fact that there have been reductions in the past in any state can be explained, a journalist would say, by the reductions in all states. So how do we – so we get back to that issue. How do we, through the systematic change, prove that we're improving public safety, that we're making people's lives safer?
Yeah, I think the numbers clearly show it, right? There are national trends, and then there are state-by-state trends. And what you really have to do if you want to examine this closely is take a look at Texas, take a look at South Carolina, take a look at Georgia, take a look at Ohio and some of the other states that have made these changes. And what's clear is that they've been able to save a tremendous amount of taxpayer money by not having to build and open and staff new prisons. And they've been able to do so while continuing along with that general national trend towards lower crime over the past several years. And in the last couple of years, the numbers also sort of mirror the national average. So what's starting to happen, Len, is that there's the myth that incarceration and crime rates move together in some lockstep. That myth is being shattered. It's being shattered in state after state across the country, where states that have reduced their incarceration rates have also reduced their crime rates. In fact, the 29 states that have reduced their incarceration rates over the past few years, the crime rate has gone down in all of them but three.
So, and that's your point. The point is that there has been systematic change in these states. If you're going to predict the fact that there's been less incarceration, that your crime rate is going up, that hasn't happened.
No, it hasn't.
So it's gone down concurrently with a reduction within the prison population.
It has, and I think the conversation at the national level, and when you talk at sort of a big conceptual level, it immediately does go toward, well, what's the relationship between crime and incarceration? At the local level, the state level, what policymakers are starting to realize when they've seen, okay, we're not building these prisons, okay, we're scaling this back and crime is going down, or it's maybe starting to tick up a little bit nationally, what's going on here, they start to look at other factors that influence the crime rate, particularly the police. And this is where, right, you need to make sure that in part of these conversations, what's happened with the ranks of police forces across this country gets right? Some time in that conversation, because police forces have had to lay off, in some cases, tremendous
proportions. Oh, in New Jersey, there are towns that have laid off 50% of their people. It's been amazing what's going on throughout the country.
Right. So at the local level, people are starting to see, right, this is not all just about how many people you put in prison and how long you keep them there. Definitely one factor, right? Nobody in this conversation, in a serious conversation about these issues, is going to argue that the increase in imprisonment didn't have any impact on the reduction in crime.
And that's a good point.
What we're seeing now, though, is that most people, including policymakers, are realizing that we have passed a tipping point on this, right? We've long since now passed a point of diminishing returns where not only will more prisons not necessarily reduce crime, they're just not even close to the most cost of more prisons, not close to the most cost effective way to reduce crime.
I want to get very quickly to the other thing that I've heard from reporters is that it's principally, this whole issue is principally a way for states to cut costs, not necessarily public safety, but a way to cut costs. But before I get to that, I'm going to reintroduce you. Adam Gelb is at our microphones today. He is the director of the Public Safety Performance Project of Pew. Certainly Pew, as I said before, I'm not quite sure that I can be more praised or suggest more praise for Pew than I possibly can. It is either the leader of change in the criminal justice system in this country, or certainly a partner with a lot of other organizations in terms of systematic change within the criminal justice system within in this country. www.pewpublicsafety.org, www.pewpublicsafety.org. The criticism that Leonard, okay, so all these states are doing all these things because they're just sick and tired of spending so much money on incarceration, and that's all you're doing. Yes, you're cutting costs, and that's well documented, but you know they're doing it solely for that. They're not doing it for systematic change within the criminal justice system.
Budget trouble is definitely bringing states to the table. It's just not the meal.
Okay.
Right? Policymakers across the country are not holding their noses and saying, I know this is going to really cause an increase in crime, and I hate to do it, but we do have to, at the state level, make ends meet. We have to balance our budget. Mm-hmm. So, we're just going to have to make some of these tough policy calls. That is not what we see happening in state after state. What we do see happening are three things. First is they are seeing the success of states like Texas and South Carolina and other states that we just talked about, mm-hmm. states that have significantly bent the curve on their prison growth and even reduced population and are seeing reduced recidivism because of the reinvestment into stronger probation and parole programs, and they're seeing those state crime rates go down. So they're starting to see this iron linkage broken between locking up more people and having safer streets. The second thing that's happening is they're becoming increasingly aware of where the public is on this. Mm-hmm. I think our polling has helped there, but more and more in daily conversation, you find that people realize at this point, after 25, 30 years of ever-increasing prison populations, that we're not going to build our way to public safety. Mm-hmm. We are, and that there are much more effective and less expensive approaches for lower-level offenders. Mm-hmm. They also are aware that and think that they don't have some specific amount of time that they want to see offenders behind bars for. They want to see a high percentage of the sentence served, but they don't really care if that's a 5-year sentence or a 3-year sentence. They just mm-hmm. want to know when the judge says 3 years, you're going to serve pretty much all that 3 years. That is starting to seep into some of these conversations. Other parts of the public opinion constellation here include victims speaking out mm-hmm. and also saying now this is not all about locking up as many people for as long as possible. This is I realize these people are going to get out and I want them to pay restitution. I want to be held accountable.
Sure.
I also don't want them to claim new victims. And so we need to strengthen reentry. We have business leaders, Len, stepping forward in many of these states and saying this is now an issue for just the overall economic vitality of the state. The corrections budgets have been the second fastest growing part of state budgets
That's
behind only
what
Medicaid.
I want to explore.
And this is not the right way to go. Let me just add that we certainly have a lot of conservative voices that you've mentioned that are speaking up here now and realizing that having 1 in 100 adults behind bars is not consistent with conservative notions of limited government and fiscal discipline.
Let me get into that. For the first time in my over 40 years within the criminal justice system, over 33 years of doing public affairs for the criminal justice system, I'm seeing people on both sides of the political aisle come together under one banner, under one topic, and that is, again, systematic change, doing it differently, getting a better result for our criminal justice dollar. I've not seen that before. I've not seen some of the public opinion data that you're sharing swinging in the direction of, hey, let's not have 75-80% recidivism in terms of rearrest. Let's not have 50% recidivism in terms of reincarceration. The state simply can't afford that. My God, we don't have money for schools. We don't have money for colleges. Can we reduce this rate of recidivism? Can we rearrange how we do things? I've never seen such a coalescence of opinion from disparate groups before on this issue of crime and justice.
There's a tremendous shift that's happening, and it's hard to put your finger on exactly why it's happening. Why is Jeb Bush? Why is Newt Gingrich? Why are Grover Norquist, Bill Bennett, David Keene? Why are these folks who are and have been leaders of the conservative movement coming forward now and saying the system has gotten too big, it's gotten too expensive, it needs to be rethought dramatically?
It needs to be more effective at what it does.
And it really derives, right, the point in time is sort of is what's hard to fix. The reasons behind it are not difficult to discern at all, right? One is straightforward limited government. Mm-hmm. 1 in 100 behind bars, almost 1 in 31 under some form of correctional supervision, prison, jail, probation, mm-hmm. Parole, be even a little higher if we counted pretrial. Mm-hmm. That is big and it's costly. And so that's one perspective, the limited government perspective and the fiscal discipline perspective. There are also big strains of this movement that look at the victim piece of this mm-hmm. and recognize that serving time in state prison does not do anything to help make that victim whole, mm-hmm. Particularly lower level property offenders, that it's more consistent with conservative notions of justice.
Let me just stop you there. The focus is violent offenders versus nonviolent offenders, and so much of this focus is looking at the nonviolent offenders, and can we do quote-unquote something else with the nonviolent offenders? The violent offenders, we're basically making room for the more dangerous folks, are we not, in terms of this whole concept of effectiveness?
That is a constant theme in the states. What policymakers tell us they want to see out of the policy packages, and they certainly see this when they look at the data in terms of increasing numbers of technical violators taking up prison space, is that's not who they want behind bars. They want behind bars the serious, the chronic, the violent, the high-risk offenders.
Okay, we only have 8 minutes left in the program. I want to ask a personal question, and I want to move on to policy issues. Number one, you've ridden this horse from the very beginning, and I would imagine as you're sitting on top of your horse when you started with Pew and you're looking out, all you can see is 10,000 cattle milling about, and you're saying to yourself, it's impossible to get all these critters moving in one direction, and you have. So what is your personal sense of accomplishment after all these years, or non-accomplishment?
There are a lot of cynics who think that this is all about the budgets, as you just said, right? This is that we're really not adding a lot of value here. This would either be happening anyway, or it's happening only because of the budgets, that there's really not some fundamental shift in the national conversation here. And even if there is, it'll be temporary, and it mm-hmm. won't last beyond when budgets recover. Mm-hmm. That's not what we see happening, right? We do see a fundamental shift in the conversation and the perspective on this issue happening. We had for a long time a situation where policymakers thought it was the right approach to this issue, and it was their job to say, how do I demonstrate that I'm tough on crime?
Right.
Now what they're saying is, how do I get taxpayers a better public safety return on their correction spending? And I think that's an important shift, and it's one that'll last.
Give me 5 specifics because I think it was a very modest answer. I think I would have been scared half to death sitting on top of that horse looking out at the sea of cattle that I couldn't. I'm trying to get moving in one direction. I think you're being extremely modest. Number two, and I think Pew is being modest. I think Pew should crow more about what it's done. I think it's been a sea change. Number two, give me, and reporters ask me this all the time, give me the five fundamental changes that one needs to advocate for to provide systematic change that reduce cost and improves public safety all at the same time. The first, from a parole and probation perspective that I always give, is to do an independent analysis of that individual to judge their risk to public safety and to judge what their needs are. So you're dealing with that person individually, not just as a class, so you can design a program that will specifically deal with what it is that he or she needs, risk and needs assessment. That's one of my answers. Do you have others?
There are many. To build off of what you were just saying, we do know now what works to stop the cycle of recidivism. No magic bullets, no way to guarantee that somebody's not going to commit another crime, but we do know how to do risk assessment much better. We do have much better surveillance technology. We know...
GPS, is that what we're talking about?
We're talking about GPS. We're talking about rapid result drug tests. So we know more about how to change behavior. We have better technologies to help us do that.
Better accountability tools.
Across the board.
Okay.
It's very different. The challenge is less so in terms of knowing what to do, but in terms of actually getting it done.
Right.
And what we're seeing in these states is the recognition that there are a good number of lower-level offenders in the prison system, particularly those who are technical violators and not committed a new crime or not been convicted of a new crime.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can change laws and practices about who goes in, and you can capture some of those savings and reinvest them into some of the probation and parole programs that follow the evidence.
What we call justice reinvestment.
Some of the new technologies, then you can have a tremendous impact on both costs and on public safety.
All right. So the state saves $20 million. You want 10 of that reinvested in the programs, parole and probation or rehab programs or treatment programs that could have a direct impact on the rest of the people staying out of the criminal justice system.
That's the formula.
Okay. What else?
One of the things that we're seeing a lot of interest in the states is in swift and certain sanctions. States are realizing that you have to hold people accountable.
And sanctions means the guy under supervision screws up and you've got to do something about him.
There's an immediate and a swift response, but it's not severe. You don't wait until somebody violates 10, 12 times,
okay,
and then do something about it. There's also a lot of interest in incentives, right? For a long time, the prison system has incentivized good behavior behind the walls by saying, right, you could earn credits off your sentence. What we're seeing now is a lot of states interested in transferring that concept to the community and saying, if you're out on probation or parole and you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, you're going to treatment, you're testing clean, and so on, you're paying your victim restitution, then you can earn time off your supervision period. And that does two things. It incentivizes good behavior by offenders and compliant behavior, and then it culls off the lower risk offenders off of caseloads, right? So that so that supervision officers can actually spend their time on people who are not complying, and that's what research tells us is going to produce the biggest impact on public safety.
People have suggested to me that we've got to reduce the amount of time spent on parole and probation. If you have a person for 5 years on parole and probation, that person's going to go back. You cannot, you know, the Pope could not live a clean time on parole and probation. I apologize if I've been disrespectful to anybody. Anybody could not live 5 years on parole and probation without messing up, without the possibility of returning back to the prison system. So some people suggest is that you tell the person, you give me one good year of no violations, you work, no drug positives, you do all the things you're supposed to do. If you're a nonviolent offender, I'll go back. And then after a year of compliance, I'll go back and recommend that we no longer supervise you. But across the board, people are recommending lower numbers, lower times for supervision and parole and probation.
That's right. I think practice is starting to catch up with the research on this question.
Anything else quickly? We got about 30 seconds left.
Yeah, I think you're asking about interventions and programs. Yes. I'd like to really put the emphasis on the process.
Okay.
And I think one of the reasons why states have been as successful as they have been working with us and CSG and others on this is that they have not put the cart before the horse. They've taken a look at their data. They've taken a look at their systems and from that determine what policies and programs are missing and what's the best fit. And that has just been an absolutely critical part of this process. It's changed the whole thing around from what's a good program or what should we do ideologically to what does the data say.
So if we're going to have systematic change, we need systematic analysis. And that's where Pew and BJA and OJP and the Center for State Governments, that's where they all come in.
That's right.
All right. Adam, it's been a fascinating conversation. It went by way too fast, as it always does. Adam Galvez is the director of the Public Safety Performance Project for Pew, www.pewpublicsafety.org, www.pewpublicsafety.org. Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. We appreciate your comments. We even appreciate your criticisms, and we want everybody to have themselves a very, very pleasant day.